when the leader of a third world country openly and defiantly proclaims his nation's sovereignty and refuses to buckle under the pressure of new imperial powers, the radical sadists and war hawks in Washington resort to their hideous regime change playbook. We witnessed it again recently in Pakistan, but the result was different. Prime Minister Imran Khan, to employ a cricket slang, bowled a vicious reverse swing to thwart what he dubbed a foreign-backed plot. More than 3 years after taking the reins as the Muslim-majority country's prime minister, Imran Khan faced the biggest test of his political career on Sunday, 3rd of April. The opposition, with tacit backing of the country's powerful military, moved a no-trust motion against the cricketer-turned-politician, but the vote was dismissed by the parliament. Deputy Speaker of Pakistan's National Assembly, Qasim Suri, asserted that no foreign power will be allowed to topple an elected government through a conspiracy, calling the vote against the sitting premier unconstitutional under Article 5 of Pakistan's constitution. Qasim Suri's loud announcement was met with vociferous slogans and chaos inside the lower house of Pakistan's parliament. There were anti-American slogans as well. In his televised address on the state-run television, Imran Khan congratulated the people of Pakistan and reiterated that the move to overthrow him was a foreign conspiracy. He also requested Pakistani President Arif Alvi to dissolve the parliament, which was done immediately under Article 58 of the Constitution, and called on the nation to gear up for a fresh election. Information Minister Fawad Chaudhary said Imran Khan will continue in his chair until the fresh vote is held, but it remains unclear how things will proceed. Imran Khan won't be completing his full term, something no prime minister has done in the South Asian country's history, but he clearly outsmarted the regime change plotters in Washington. Before the high drama vote on Sunday, the embattled prime minister had rejected calls to step down, vowing to fight until the end. He didn't blame his domestic rivals for plotting his downfall, but claimed a foreign plot behind the move. It was a revelation hard to dismiss, regardless of political affiliations. In an emotional televised speech on Thursday, 31st of March, the flamboyant skipper, who has heroically led Pakistan to its first and only Cricket World Cup triumph in 1992, blasted Washington for ganging up with his political opponents in a bid to remove him from office. Imran Khan referred to a letter received by Pakistan's outgoing ambassador to Washington, Asad Majid Khan, from a senior U.S. State Department official, which was sent to Islamabad on 7th of March, a day before Pakistan's opposition parties made the first move to table a no-trust motion against Imran Khan in the National Assembly. Calling the letter evidence of an international conspiracy to topple his government, Imran Khan affirmed in his speech on Thursday, 31st of March, "To an independent country, a message like this that apparently is against the Prime Minister is actually against our nation." According to senior Pakistani journalist Naseem Zahra, the threatening letter warned that the U.S.-Pakistan relations will not improve with Imran Khan in power and that Pakistan will be forgiven only once he's ousted. As Imran Khan rightly said, that pointed to brazen foreign meddling in Pakistan's domestic affairs. It didn't come out of the blue, of course. Before his Thursday speech that made headlines, Imran Khan had also pointed to it at a recent massive public rally in Islamabad. He called the no-confidence vote against him at home a foreign conspiracy, linking it to his recent visit to Moscow at the height of the Ukraine crisis. The timing of Imran Khan's visit to Russia, just hours before the Kremlin launched a military operation in Ukraine, and his refusal to join the Western bloc in condemning the operation at the United Nations General Assembly, turned him into an overnight villain and outlaw. Imran Khan became the first Pakistani prime minister to visit Moscow in 23 years, showing growing proximity in their bilateral relations. However, what grabbed headlines was the timing of the visit and its immediate aftermath. Quite expectedly, it raised eyebrows in the US and Europe, with Washington even telling Islamabad that it was watching Imran Khan's visit. The message carried a subtle warning: don't get too close to the Russians. Imran Khan, however, chose defiance instead of tame submission. He went a step further when he lashed out at the European Union for asking him to vote against Moscow at the United Nations General Assembly, saying they shouldn't treat Pakistan as their slave. Asking European Union diplomats whether they also wrote such letters to India, their strange neighbour and a strategic rival, the firebrand Prime Minister said at a public rally recently, "What do you think of us? Are we your slaves, that whatever you say we will do?" The warmth between Pakistan and regional powers like Russia and China is a hard pill to swallow for the West, including the United States. Imran Khan, since taking office in 2018, has shown serious intent to forge closer ties with both countries, which has pushed his country away from the United States. Interestingly, Joe Biden is yet to make a call to Imran Khan since taking office in early 2021. It's true that the United States and the European Union are still Pakistan's biggest trading partners, and that's the card they have played for years to keep Islamabad subservient to them. Imran Khan, unlike his predecessors, sought to assert his country's independence in foreign policy and in trade, embracing new all-weather allies like Russia and China. In a February interview, Imran Khan hit out at the United States for using Pakistan for its own strategic goals and then abandoning it and imposing sanctions, citing an example of Pakistan-US relations in the 1980s when the South Union forces were deployed to Afghanistan. It was Pakistan that Americans banked on that time. What has also ruffled feathers in the corridors of power in Washington is Imran Khan's scathing criticism of America's military adventures in neighboring Afghanistan. After the botched exit last August, Imran Khan censured Washington for the mess it was leaving behind in the war-ravaged country after 20 years of fighting. He also refused to allow Pakistan to be used for over-the-horizon U.S. missions against targets in Afghanistan. So it's pretty evident that the aborted move to overthrow him was remotely controlled in a bid to install a US-friendly government in Islamabad. That his political opponents joined hands with the regime change hawks in Washington only smacked of political opportunism and deceit. Imran Khan has been accused of economic mismanagement by his key political opponents, including the likes of Shahbaz Sharif and Bilawal Bhutto Zardari. While it's true that Pakistan grapples with serious economic woes, it will be grossly unfair to lay the blame squarely on Imran Khan and his party, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. He inherited the mess from his predecessors, who have now conveniently taken up cudgels against him. To his credit, Imran Khan managed to steer the country out of the COVID-19 crisis, combated institutionalized corruption, forged close alliances with both Beijing and Moscow, played a key role in the Afghan peace process, fought the wave of Islamophobia, and amassed the country's foreign reserves to over $18 billion. As Imran Khan declared a few days ago, in a remarkably defiant tone, he will come back with more power, so it will be too naive and too early to write his political obituary.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this programme, we will address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organisations, the people, and also the region as a whole. So, stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how Iran, which has for the past four decades been host to one of the largest and most protracted refugee situations in the world, continues to embrace Afghan refugees. And we shall expose the blatant duplicity of Western countries who continue to deport and cold-shoulder refugees from Afghanistan.
The hasty and irresponsible exit of US-led foreign forces and Taliban's sweeping takeover in Afghanistan August last year was followed by freezing of Afghan assets worth billions of dollars. It plunged the South Asian country into an unimaginable economic crisis, forcing millions of people to flee their homes and belongings. A large majority of these people took refuge in neighbouring Iran, which, unlike the Western countries that occupied and wreaked havoc in Afghanistan for 20 years, warmly embraced the fleeing Afghan refugees.
After the Taliban laid siege to Kabul on August the 15th last year, drawing the curtains on a 20-year-long foreign military occupation, the US and its allies rushed to cut off Afghanistan's access to international aid and froze nearly $10 billion in assets belonging to the country's central bank. The International Monetary Fund and World Bank followed suit. Besides spawning the worst humanitarian crisis in recent history, the situation also displaces millions of Afghans, forcing them to flee to neighboring countries. Hundreds of thousands of Afghans have made their way across the border into Iran in the last 6 months, negotiating the treacherous terrain and braving enormous risks. According to international aid organizations, around 4,000 to 5,000 people are streaming into Iran each day, escaping the horrors of poverty and insecurity fueled by the US and its allies. While many of them come through illegal channels, paying smugglers hefty money, many others have arrived through proper legal channels. Despite the fact that the Iranian economy has been in a tailspin because of crippling US sanctions, the incoming Afghan refugees have been accorded warm reception and provided necessary facilities. Iran's assistance to the war-weary Afghan refugees has been largely without any international aid.
The Iranian approach for Afghan refugees needs to be supported. Most of the refugees here are living in the community. You know, this is something that we are actually promoting through the Global Compact. In this particular situation where additional pressure is put on the country and this has repercussions that we all know about, it is more difficult for the government to sustain a policy that is so inclusive in respect of refugees.
While rich Western countries have erected walls to prevent the entry of Afghan refugees, Iran has opened its gates and hearts to them despite the difficult economic conditions in the country. From prioritizing the vaccination of Afghan refugees to providing them equal educational opportunities, Iran's approach to the Afghan refugee crisis has been full of compassion and humanity. Top UN officials have acknowledged the role played by Iran in alleviating the suffering of ill-fated Afghan refugees while urging the world to share the burden.
The domestic political climate in the US and Europe has turned increasingly hostile to asylum seekers from Afghanistan. The new Afghan refugee exodus has caused jitters in Europe, where politicians fear a repeat of the 2015 migrant crisis. On the other hand, Iran, which already plays host to more than 3 million refugees from Afghanistan, has embraced almost a million more in the last 6 months.
Well, the West has always failed the Afghans, you know, whether it's refugees or the Afghan people. You know, they betrayed us in the past and they betrayed us again. They betrayed us in the 80s and 90s and now again, you know, in 2021. They destroyed our country, they invaded our country, they created refugees, and when the time came that Afghan needed help to run away from the Taliban, you know, they shut their, you know, borders and it make it so difficult, you know. Even now in Britain, you know, if you're an Afghan and if you arrive on the back of the lorry or if you arrive on a boat or a ship, you know, you might be ending up in prison for up to 4 years, you know, which is totally against the basic international human rights law on asylum and immigration or asylum seekers or refugees. But, you know, the current mess in our country is created by the West. It's the West which is responsible. They went to Afghanistan, invaded our country, and then fought the Taliban for 20 years, the longest war. You know, killed thousands, hundreds of thousands of innocent people by Afghan security forces, by the Taliban, by the Islamic State, by foreign forces. And when the time came, you know, that the Afghan needed help, you know, the West shut everything on their faces and abandoned and betrayed the Afghans.
Ivo Friesen, UN Refugee Agency's representative in Iran, recently admitted that the amount of assistance provided by international organizations to address the needs of Afghan refugees in Iran was small, and most of the support was coming from the Iranian government and people. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian, in his meeting with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi in Tehran mid-December, described the agency's assistance to Iran woefully insufficient. The lack of assistance from the international community, however, has not deterred Iran from embracing Afghan refugees. Iran's Health Minister Bahram Einollahi, in his remarks recently, asserted that Afghan refugees were given health services, including COVID-19 vaccines, on a par with Iranian nationals. Afghan refugees also avail opportunities to enroll in schools and universities on scholarships. The process to ease visa rules for Afghan nationals is also underway. All this bears testimony to Iran's humane refugee policy, unlike the West.
The blockade of Afghan assets by the US and its allies has precipitated the worst humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. At the same time, US sanctions on Iran have created huge impediments in the way of the Islamic Republic's ability to assist the fleeing Afghan refugees. Both Iran's foreign ministry as well as the country's mission to the UN Security Council have sounded the alarm, urging the world community to share the burden of Afghanistan's refugee crisis, which they helped create in the first place.
While Iran has, in line with its refugee policy, provided necessary assistance to refugees coming from Afghanistan, it has continued to remind the international community of its responsibility toward the people displaced by the 20-year-long failed military adventure of the US and its NATO allies. Iran's envoy to the UN, Majid Takht-Ravanchi, speaking at a UN Security Council session on Afghanistan on January the 27th, asserted that Tehran had done all in its power to support Afghan refugees over the past four decades, despite harsh sanctions. He said that financial constraints due to US sanctions were impeding Iran's efforts to assist incoming refugees in the absence of international assistance. He further noted Iran had kept its borders with Afghanistan open to ease both the people's movement and trade after the Taliban takeover last year.
Always, you know, the West have this weapon, you know. Sanction is very easy for the West, you know. When you launch an illegal war, you know, and then you fail, you know, you have no strategy. And then you empower the most vicious warlords and drug lords and rapists and thieves, bandits, you know, and corrupt people, you know, in Asian countries. And then when the time comes to, you know, to take your responsibility and say, look, you know, I got it wrong and I'm sorry and apologize to the people. That's how, you know, the West is famous for. You know, they go to a country, they sanction them, they invade them, they destroy their infrastructure. And then, you know, the poor people pay the price, you know, sanction always, you know, whether it's in Yemen or Afghanistan or Iran or, you know, some other countries, you know, or Cuba, you know, it kills innocent people. You know, it doesn't kill the rich because the rich have the money. They have the resources. They can move around anywhere they want, you know. But it's the poor, especially the women and the children who pay the heavy price. And they're the victims of, you know, fail, you know, wars, you know, like in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and you know, in Sudan, in Somalia, and so many other countries.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, during his meeting with the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in Munich, echoed same concerns, stressing the need for continued humanitarian assistance to Afghans while calling for greater assistance by the UN Refugee Agency to Iran. The top UN official, for his part, commended Iran's generosity for hosting millions of Afghans while calling on the global community to collaborate in managing the unfolding crisis.
Of nearly 6 million Afghan refugees, almost 90% are hosted by Afghanistan's two closest neighbors, Iran and Pakistan. Iran alone is home to more than 3 million Afghan refugees. Before the latest refugee exodus triggered by the botched U.S. exit, Iran has for the past four decades been host to one of the largest and most protracted urban refugee situations in the world. According to aid agencies, around 4,000 to 5,000 refugees have been entering Iran each day in recent months through informal border crossings.
Iran, which is home to around 1 million documented and 2 million undocumented Afghan refugees, shares a 572-mile porous border with the neighboring country. Its refugee policy has been consistent since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, providing safe refuge to people fleeing war and persecution. The Norwegian Refugee Council, an independent humanitarian organization providing assistance to refugees across the world, has commended Iran for welcoming and hosting millions of displaced Afghans for the past four decades. In a statement recently, the organization called on the international community to step up to support Iran and urged rich nations to both ramp up aid and keep their borders open to people fleeing conflict and persecution.
It has been commendable that Iran has been hosting refugees, primarily from Afghanistan, for more than 40 years now, which is an important feature, an important achievement, and a commendable achievement. It also means that, as UNHCR, with other international partners, we see it as our task to continue to try and give as much support to the authorities in these efforts, for as long as refugees are here, with, of course, the ultimate solution being that Afghanistan becomes stable, fully stable, so that people can go back in safety, voluntarily, and with dignity. Iran has done very well over the years in making basic social services accessible for refugees. This is what we would like to see, what the international norm is, that systems are accessible for refugees, basic social services. Education, we all recall the importance of the decree by the leader in 2015, so that Afghan children can now access education services just like any other child in Iran.
The progressive and inclusive policies of the successive governments in Tehran have ensured that refugees are provided equal access to education, health, and livelihood opportunities. According to estimates, more than 96% of Afghan refugees live in Iranian cities, towns, and villages alongside their Iranian host communities, while 4% are put up in more than a dozen settlements managed by the Interior Ministry in collaboration with the UN Refugee Agency. Iran has acceded to both the 1951 UNHCR Convention and its 1967 Protocol, which define the legal status of refugees across the world.
Thank you. You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Mustafa Ariyayi at Covert Action magazine. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Ariyayi. Now, at a time when Western countries are closing their doors and deporting Afghan refugees, Iran has openly embraced them. Now, what is your take on this contrast in refugee policies?
Well, I totally agree. As your question presupposes, there is indeed a difference in policy. We often hear from Western politicians and the Western media, mainstream media rather, how they brag about human rights and how they try to be bound by the rule of law. And that certainly does apply to refugees or those people who are subjected to inhumane situation and therefore have to fled their country. But the reality, unfortunately, is sometimes very different. Iran, I personally want to thank the Iranian people and on behalf of so many Afghans who have sought refuge in a brother nation like Iran. And Iran for the last decade has accepted and openly embraced millions upon millions of Afghanis, helpless Afghanis, people who were forced to leave their country because there was a political crisis, there was even war. And you know, after so many years, unfortunately, the situation in Afghanistan has only exacerbated ever since. But still, for the Iranian nation, they felt the obligation made itself felt to help their neighbor. And for that, I really want to thank them. Unfortunately, on the part of the Western world, the problem is that they always have a narrative. But that narrative doesn't necessarily line up with the reality. And the Afghan refugee issue is certainly a manifestation of that, where you see that a lot of Western countries are very adamant and even trying to refrain themselves from accepting so many Afghanis. But that is somehow very weird because in the first place, it was Western country that has contributed to the situation as such in Afghanistan. And then to say that we should have a closed-door policy towards Afghanis, that is a bit rich, to say the least.
Now, as we've seen, Iran has for the past four decades been host to one of the largest and most protected refugee situations in the world. Now, is it fair to say it's time for the world to step up and share the burden as well?
I totally agree with that. I think Iran, neighboring countries in particular, and most notably Iran, has always stood by the Afghan people by and large, even in the midst of a war. I remember, many Afghans remember it very well when there was the 8 years war between Iraq and Iran. Even at that very point, Iran accepted openly so many Afghans. And Iran alone, given its current financial situation, cannot handle the problem, of course. Where the Western world, you see a lot of right-wing politicians and leftists, there is a battle between them on in terms of how to regulate the migrant crisis. But they really take an issue when it's about 10,000 refugees or accepting 10,000 refugees on an annual basis. But Iran has already is hosting millions upon millions of Afghanis, and I think it's absolutely time to have a frank discussion about that and to accept the fact that Iran indeed alone and also a country like Pakistan cannot bear the burden alone anymore.
Now, another important fact is that Iran has been providing assistance to Afghan refugees without any substantial international support and in the face of the crippling U.S. sanctions. Now, how do you see this?
Yes, I was already alluding to that issue of the financial situation in Iran, and those crippling U.S. sanctions has largely contributed to the situation as such in Iran. It has not only affected ordinary Iranian people, but as an extension, also many Afghanis or many other refugee groups residing in Iran. And I personally believe that the illegal U.S. sanction or Western sanction imposed upon the Iranian nation should come to a speedy and unconditional end, as Iran is doing everything at its end of the bargaining table. Iran has complied with the norms established by the IAEA within the framework of the IAEA, and everything what they do lines up with the NPT. So there is no reason to prolong the sanctions, illegal sanctions rather, against Iran. And in addition to that, it was the U.S. who unilaterally decided to exit the agreement with Iran. I think that yes, the sanctions against Iran are not only hurting the Iranian people, but also to a very large extent Afghani refugees. And it would be very good if the sanctions would come to an end.
Mr. Arya, do you think the unfolding Afghan refugee crisis can be managed if the U.S. and its international partners unfreeze Afghan assets and facilitate aid to the crisis-stricken country?
I think it would give some space to breathe again, but on the long run, I think there much more is needed, of course. This is a humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, and it's unknown in scale. So I think that on the long run, much more should be done than only unfreezing Afghan assets. In addition, I think that Afghanistan strongly needs a regional solution rather than an international one. It would be a very good start, but it's not everything.
Sir, as we know, the latest Afghan refugee exodus was triggered by the botched U.S. military exit from Afghanistan last August. Now, is it fair to say that the Americans owe reparations to these displaced Afghans?
I think they do. Oh, yes, absolutely. Like I said in the introduction, we're talking about a crisis that they, when I'm talking about they, I'm alluding to the West. They have started the crisis in Afghanistan in the first place. They went into Afghanistan under false premises, by the way. The hijackers of 9/11 attack were not even Afghanis. So, but, you know, by the operation of international law, they somehow knew how to justify the so-called war against terror. But 20 years after, we saw what kind of a detrimental effect it had on many Afghans. I think that the United States does owe reparation to not only to displaced Afghans, but to Afghanistan as such. So they actually left the Afghan people alone, and they couldn't care what would happen with the Afghan people.
Ms. Arya, thank you for being on the program again. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
There's one from Ivo Friesen himself, that's a UNHCR representative in Iran, who stresses the importance of the international community coming together to share responsibility with Iran in hosting Afghan refugees. Susan Naomi is an Afghan-American activist who says, "The U.S. and Europe are in no position to criticize Iran and Pakistan, who have been taking in Afghan refugees despite the COVID-19 pandemic and U.S. sanctions." We've got a comment from a Bristol-based social worker, Ozgul Gochen, who commends Iran for hosting millions of Afghan refugees despite crippling U.S. sanctions, calling on the world community to pay its historical debt to Iran. Filippo Grandi, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, thanks Iran for including Afghan refugees in its COVID-19 vaccine campaign, praising the country for its inclusive policies and services. The Norwegian Refugee Council Secretary General Jan Egelin tells a British newspaper that more people have been crossing the Afghanistan-Iran border every day than those accumulated altogether on the border of Poland and Belarus.
And that was our episode about the unfolding Afghan refugee crisis and Iran's humane, compassionate response to it. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A major new United Nations report setting out the action needed to tackle the climate crisis was released on Monday, 4th of April, after marathon talks to agree its findings. The latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, is expected to set out the rapid action required to curb global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or below 2 degrees Celsius, including deep cuts to fossil fuels with a switch to technology such as renewable energies. The article you're about to hear has been written by the London Evening Standard journalist Emily Beaumont. The piece is titled, UN to Release New Report on Action to Tackle Climate Crisis After Marathon Talks. A new United Nations report setting out the action needed to tackle the climate crisis was released on Monday, 4th of April, after marathon talks to agree its findings. The latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, is expected to set out the rapid action required to curb global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or below 2 degrees Celsius, including deep cuts to fossil fuels with a switch to technology such as renewable energies. The report from the United Nations Science Body, which was released on Monday, highlighted measures to cut emissions from the energy sector, from the agricultural sector and land, cities, buildings, industry and transport. It also emphasized the role of consumer behavior and looked at ways to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, including through activities such as planting trees and new technology, and the challenges involved. It is clear that the solutions are cheaper than the impacts, that acting to tackle the climate crisis is cheaper than not acting. But the two-week-long online meeting of scientists and representatives of 195 governments to approve the summary of the report line by line ran late into Sunday, well past the Friday 1st of April scheduled finish time, as delegates wrangled over the text. The approval process means that when the final version was released, governments have signed off on the findings. But it has been slow progress to secure agreement on the report, which outlined the need to swiftly and dramatically cut greenhouse gases, particularly by reducing fossil fuel use. The inclusion of language on curbing coal power and fossil fuel subsidies in the Glasgow Pact agreed at United Nations climate talks in Scotland late last year, provoked heated debate between countries heavily reliant on fossil fuels and those most threatened by the impacts of climate change. The new United Nations report comes as soaring energy prices and supply pressures, worsened by the conflict in Ukraine, have prompted renewed debate over security of energy supplies and whether to accelerate climate action or exploit more oil and gas resources. In the United Kingdom, the fossil fuel industry and some MPs in the House of Commons have urged a restart to controversial fracking or more extraction from North Sea oil and gas. But there have also been widespread calls for insulating homes, more renewable energies and weaning the country off gas in response to the crisis. The British government is set to unveil its new energy security strategy this week, with expectations it will set out plans to boost new nuclear power capacity, solar energy and offshore wind. But there appears to have been a debate within the government over the role of onshore wind, although it is cheap and popular with the public, and any efforts to boost domestic oil and gas production in the strategy will prove controversial with campaigners. The new United Nations report is the third installment of the sixth assessment report, an overarching analysis of the world's knowledge on climate change, and the first of its kind since 2014. The first part of the assessment, which looked at the physical basis of climate change and was released in August of 2021, found humans are unequivocally driving global warming, with the effects already being felt. It was labelled a code red for humanity by United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres. When the second report was released in February of this year, detailing the impacts of rising temperatures and the options and limits to adapting to them, Antonio Guterres described it as an atlas of human suffering and a damning indictment of failed climate leadership. It found climate change has led to increasing heat and heat waves, rising sea levels, rising number of floods, wildfires and drought, causing death, food and water scarcity and migration. Ahead of the latest report's publication, Greenpeace UK senior climate advisor Charlie Kronick said, "Our fossil fuel dependence is funding war, and soaring gas prices are hurting millions of households. We already have good reasons to move away from oil and gas and invest in insulation and heat pumps to cut energy wastage from our homes." But on Monday, the world's leading climate scientists reminded us of the other major reason we must do so: to stop the climate disaster threatening everything we hold dear. Sam Hall, director of the Conservative Environment Network, which includes dozens of Tory MPs, said the goals of energy security, cost of living and cutting emissions to net zero to tackle climate change all pull in the same direction. The answer remains the same in all cases: clean energy deployment, reducing fossil fuel consumption and improving energy efficiency. Gareth Redmond-King, international lead at the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit, said the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has set out solutions to the climate crisis. Gareth Redmond-King said, "It sets out in some detail how we respond to the alarm and avoid the apocalyptic future we know we're heading for if we don't act. It is clear that the solutions are cheaper than the impacts, that acting to tackle the climate crisis is cheaper than not acting. It is now down to political leaders, particularly G20 leaders, as the largest economies and biggest emitters of carbon dioxide, to choose how bad we let things get."
Economic divide.
Saudi Arabia considers ditching the dollar for Chinese oil sales. You heard me right, that is quite a shock, but really shouldn't be one, since It's been in the works for quite some time. Hi, I'm Kavit Hathaway in this edition of Economic Divide, where we look at what impact this will have on the U.S. dollar and the geopolitical implications of such a move by Saudi Arabia. Coming up in this program, Saudi Arabia and China discussing pricing some Saudi oil exports in the yuan. The U.S., meanwhile, is left out in the cold by its ally. Then we're going to take a look at the way that China is actually aggressively pushing to dethrone the dollar as the global reserve currency. And this latest development suggests the petrodollar, well, is now being threatened. And another highlight of the program, both Russia and China, they have mechanisms for an independent and financial monetary system to bypass the dollar. Will that work? Stay tuned.
The war between Russia and Ukraine had altered geopolitics and strategic alliances in Eastern Europe and is changing global economic trends as well. The U.S. has decided to ditch Russian oil from the market. Europeans have not followed that path all the way, but have said that they will decrease their dependency on Russian oil and gas. These decisions have pushed them closer to Saudi Arabia. They are urging the kingdom to pump more oil into markets to stabilize the prices. Saudi Arabia is using that as a leverage against the West. Saudi Arabia is reportedly uncomfortable with what Riyadh views as the U.S.'s waning support for the kingdom's war on Yemen and over U.S. President Joe Biden administration's attempt to strike a deal with Iran. Earlier this month, Saudi officials reportedly declined calls from the White House talks with Beijing to price some of its oil sales to China in yuan. The move could cripple the petrodollar's dominance of the global petroleum market and mark another shift by the world's top crude exporter towards Asia. Analysts believe the move is also aimed at the heart of the U.S. financial system. For decades, the U.S. financial system has taken advantage of the dollar's reserve status by printing as many dollars as needed to fund government spending. Saudi Arabia supplies 25% of China's oil. If the sales are priced in yuan, the sales would boost the standing of China's currency. Around 80% of global oil sales are done in dollars, and the Saudis have traded oil exclusively in dollars since 1974. In a deal with the Nixon administration.
Really what we're seeing is a sort of turning of the tides after COVID and a period of economic challenge in the region. And the Gulf Arab states led by the UAE and Saudi Arabia, because they're each individual at the same time, are looking to benefit from high oil prices and perhaps take some of their frustrations and differences with Washington to the negotiating table to settle those differences in particular.
You might say, here we go again. The question of the dollar's world standing is in question, but yet nothing happens. Well, this time the story is different. At least that is what many social media posts have indicated. First, the story itself. Saudi Arabia is in talks to price its oil sales to China in the yuan, people familiar with the matter have said. The move would dent the U.S. dollar's dominance of the oil market. Now, this went on to say the two nations have intermittently discussed the matter for 6 years, but talks have reportedly stepped up in 2020, with Riyadh disgruntled over the U.S.'s nuclear negotiations with Iran and its lack of backing for Saudi Arabia's military operation in neighboring Yemen. Now, this post said, end of U.S. dollar. Saudi Arabia just agreed to sell China oil and trade in Chinese yuan, not the U.S. dollar. U.S. hegemony is ending. U.S. is less of a world power. Thank you, Brandon. Just what happens next is in question. I will do my best to keep you posted before things happen. Take care. Not good. All right. This viewer, however, seems to think the yuan has a long ways to go. He has said, I regularly scoff about the wild claims about the yuan replacing the dollar as a global currency, but every time I look at the data, I'm still amazed at just how irrelevant the yuan is. The Saudi switch to the yuan seen as symbolic, not a true threat to the dollar. The Saudis are trying to play with what they can. It's just a signal sent to the U.S. that they want more consideration. No response to Saudi Arabia accepting the yuan over the dollar. Yemen suffered in the hands of Saudi Arabia, carrying U.S. armaments, and now receives aid, no choice, facing genocide. What is bad is the fact that this isn't even because of their best interest, more so a retaliation. And then we move on to this one. It says, I'm pleased to announce nearly $585 million in additional humanitarian assistance for Yemenis. We've provided nearly $4.5 billion since the beginning of the war. We continue to respond to and find inclusive political solutions to the conflict. Well, joining us for this segment of the program is Dr. Timothy Kurzweil. He's a research fellow at the Advanced Institute of Global and Contemporary China Studies at the Chinese University of Hong Kong in Shenzhen. All right, welcome to the program. The fact that we're looking at Saudi Arabia switching some of its sales into the yuan, receiving payments in the yuan, obviously that's a huge shift. It has geopolitical ramifications, and it also poses a threat, as it has been stated, to the dollar's standing. How do you see the impact of this shift that's being considered?
Well, with the U.S. and some of its allies continuing to sanction many sovereign economies, it's natural a number of them are going to look for alternatives to trading in the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar is already losing its dominance of the global petroleum market. For example, Russia moved to a policy of accelerated de-dollarization in 2014, and then Venezuela stopped trading in U.S. dollars for oil in 2018. Now, Saudi Arabia made a deal with the U.S. to conduct oil trade back in 1974 in the U.S. dollars, which was what gave the United States a way out of the 1970s oil price crisis. Now, the problem for the U.S. in 2022 is that it started abandoning regimes it previously supported, like in Afghanistan and Ukraine. So a U.S. guarantee of security doesn't really mean that much anymore. And this really makes Saudi Arabia much less tolerant of U.S. human rights lectures and far more likely to adopt an independent economic policy.
Okay, let's get the thoughts of Abid Kayyum Suleri. He's the executive director at the Sustainable Development Policy Institute. Mr. Suleri, welcome. Looking at the Russian and Chinese payment systems that each has devised, obviously this is... has been done by both in order to bypass the long arm of U.S. sanctions, which has affected both countries, in particular now Russia. You're having this move potentially being considered that probably will happen, the switch from dollar to the yuan. Do you think that that combined with, the payment system that's been devised is going to affect the standing of the dollar?
We have seen that one of the most troublesome economic sanctions for any country who is violating international norms is embargo on SWIFT. SWIFT is an international system for transferring money across borders through international banking. So if a country is excluded from that banking channel, they are... they get excluded and isolated from the rest of the world's economic relations and connections. And that's why China has already been working on an alternate to SWIFT, which is called CISP. So China is working on it, although it's quite successful, by the way, although the magnitude of transactions which have taken place on SISP is much lesser than SWIFT, but it is the second most used instrument after SWIFT.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where economic news from around the world is sifted through and then chosen to bring to you. First to the U.S., where Republicans there want to raise taxes on the poor and working class Americans. Some of the things that they want to do, they want to end Social Security, they want to end Medicare, they want to, I guess, jack up pollution and also corporate profits, all the while continuing to pamper their billionaire donor base. So there you go. Again, another reason in the U.S. where billionaires are being pampered to. Moving on next to the conflict in Ukraine, the United Nations DP, or the UNDP actually, has made a startling announcement that's a branch of the UN. It has said that every day of delayed peace will accelerate a free fall into poverty for Ukraine. And it said in the event of a continuing protracted war, which it already is, 18 years of socioeconomic achievements could be lost, with almost one-third of the population living below the poverty line and a further 62% at high risk of falling into poverty within the next 12 months. So that's really stark news for this conflict that's happening in Ukraine. Next up, Bangladesh. And the businesses there, entrepreneurs are suffering, no customers due to the COVID-19, so that's not good. This comes from endpoverty.org, which has brought a couple cases of what's happening. This is one of them. People worried about how to put food on the table, and here you have one of the entrepreneurs, or the CEO from Bangladesh, who has said the following.
If you talk about small business, big business, they don't have any transaction. You know, there's no people outside, no buyer. When we talk with the beneficiaries, our clients, their biggest concern right now is how they will provide food on the table for their kids.
We move on next to Cameroon businesses. They're not able to pay their loans. They've gone bankrupt. Again, from endpoverty.org, we have gotten this report. Basically, things are not going well there. And one of the things that Cameroon businesses have said, or that's been a consequence, is that Cameroon war crisis has had a severe impact on that country. So those were some of the stories that we covered.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The decision by Saudi Arabia to consider selling its oil in yuan, whatever percentage that may be, or to receive payments in the yuan, is something that the U.S. should be very concerned about. We will try to explain why in this in-depth section. Well, the status of the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency of the world, that is largely based on a few factors, but its importance in energy and commodity markets is what stands out. Now, according to an exclusive report from the Wall Street Journal, Saudi Arabia and China, they are now considering pricing some Saudi oil exports in the yuan. China is actually aggressively pushing to dethrone the dollar as the global reserve currency. And this latest development suggests that the petrodollar, well, is now being threatened in terms of its supremacy and being the top choice in the money basket. Well, the consequences of this switch, to whatever degree that's going to happen, is going to be quite shocking in more ways than one. Let's take a look at them. For example, switching millions of barrels of oil trades from dollars to yuan every day, well, that could actually rattle the Saudi economy, which has a currency called the rial. That currency is actually pegged to the dollar. So that obviously is going to be a threat. It could have actually unpredictable economic damage. The impact on the Saudi economy would likely depend on the number of oil sales that are involved and the price of oil. Now, some economists are sounding the alarm bell on this, saying that moving away from the dollar-denominated oil sales would diversify the kingdom's revenue base. So not only is that a cause for alarm, but at the same time, this could be a blessing in disguise in terms of Saudi Arabia diversifying its revenue base. Now, the Saudis' plan to switch to yuan could tempt other producers to price their Chinese exports in yuan as well. Some of the countries, Russia, which is going to do that, Angola, Iraq, and Iran, which has already pursued that route. Let's move on to